Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, and welcoming our dear guest, Dr. Christian Northrup. Dr. Northrup is a visionary pioneer in women's health, a board-certified OBGYN, former assistant clinical professor of OBGYN at the University of Vermont College of Medicine, and three-time New York Times best-selling author of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, The Wisdom of Menopause, and Goddesses Never Age, plus her latest book, Making Life Easy, A Simple Guide to a Divinely Inspired Life. In 2013, Reader's Digest named Dr. Northrup one of the 100 most trusted people in America. And in 2016, she was named one of Oprah Winfrey's Super Soul 100, a group of leaders who are using their voices and talent to awaken humanity. Dr. Northrup has also hosted 8 highly successful public television specials, and her work has been featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, NBC Nightly News, The View, Rachel Ray, Good Morning America, 2020, and The Dr. Oz Show. So now, Dr. Northrup, we are so grateful for this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Christian, for being with us again.
Yes, my pleasure.
Ours too. You know, it's been a central theme of your work for decades that our bodies, our minds, and our souls are profoundly intertwined. We should know that. It's obvious that Western medicine can do some amazing things, but it seems to almost completely ignore the unity of body, mind, and spirit.
Yeah, it does. and it still does.
It does.
It's fascinating to me, this. It is almost Freudian-type denial, you know, where someone says, my parents weren't alcoholics, they were just heavy social drinkers. There's this denial thing that comes in, like a woman who said to me once, she came in with bleeding between her periods, and I said, what's going on in your life? And she bristled, and she said, I think my problem is just medical. And I said, I would have asked you the same question had you broken your leg.
Yes.
Yeah,
you know,
like that.
When you say that, it's like almost Freudian in that sense. Is there fear?
Yes. Fear would mean, yes. That's a beautiful way to say it. And the fear is for some very good reason. And the reason is, if you were to know what you know, to really know what you intuitively know to be true, you would have to change something. And most likely what would happen to you is that you would have to undergo the most painful thing that a human can undergo, and that is being banished by their tribe. If we were to take a look at your own life, when you came out with your ideas on food, how was that 30 years ago? I mean, was there did the family throw you a ticker tape parade with how brilliant you were?
Hardly. Every single member of the Baskins and the Robbins families wanted nothing to do with me or my work. Although, in time, my dad, who was the founder and owner of Baskin Robbins, came to appreciate it because his cardiologist told him he should read my book if he wanted to live. He did want to live. He did read the book. He made changes, and he lived 20 more years than he would was expected to, 20 more healthy years because of the changes he made. But that was rare, and all the other members of my family, most of them to this day, actually ostracize me.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. So therefore, you have to be, you have to have support from other areas, because the pioneering spirit that changes things, which you are, which I am, is not going to be liked. When you're the first person on the block to say it, it isn't obvious to anyone. And so what the tribe wants to do to you, whether the tribe is your family, your medical colleagues, your spouse, your children, to keep the status quo they'll do whatever they can to keep you in line.
It's clearly true that as human beings, we thrive on real connection, on acceptance and intimacy. And we do best physically, emotionally, and spiritually when we're part of a tribe that values us. The need to belong is powerful. But there's a downside, and that is that many people would rather just go along with their tribe, even if doing so is dangerous and harmful, rather than risk being abandoned. You know, rather than risk leaving and being abandoned or shamed or blamed.
It's easier to die.
We all want to be part of our tribe as we know it. But it seems, Christian, that sometimes that can be, it can be that being part of a tribe that doesn't support who you really are is harmful to your health, to your spirit. It can kill you.
Let's look at all of these people who were gay, let's say in the 50s. I'm thinking of the movie The Other Side of Heaven, and it was not that long ago, actually, I think, that being homosexual was still in the DSM manual for mental health disorders until the 70s. In other words, if you were gay, let's say you're a gay man, then that was considered aberrant behavior by the entire tribe. And so
you were considered to be sick and defective.
Yes, so therefore they tried electroshock therapy. So that is exactly how dangerous it is to be different from your tribe.
So this came, we were talking a moment ago about Western medicine's fear of acknowledging all of the dimensions of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And then this fear stems from the fear of abandonment, a fear of being different and being on your own. And I know that you've said that medicating symptoms on an ongoing basis is like putting duct tape over the indicator lights on the dashboard of your car.
Yes.
Instead of looking under the hood to see what the engine is telling you.
Right.
Are you saying that then that our thoughts and our feelings and our beliefs, maybe even the soul contract we have with life, are all determinant of our physical and mental health?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And in my particular profession, when birth control pills were invented in the 60s, suddenly, because of the underlying shame about the menstrual cycle, which had been going on for centuries, you know, the curse and all of that, and women trying to hide it, we suddenly had an approved way to literally disconnect from the creativity cycles of the moon and of the earth, and then begin to cycle with the pharmaceutical industry. And it fits so perfectly into the model of the time, better living through chemistry and so on. And every other year, there'll be some article in the New York Times or the Atlantic or some erudite publication on what a pain in the ass the menstrual cycle is, and therefore why it makes sense to shut it down. So now we are giving teenagers these pellets of synthetic progestin in the arm. And if you put them in there, then you're good to go for 3 years or so. It's the ultimate high-tech masking tape for the indicator light on the dashboard, because you know, you have to ask yourself, right? If you were a squirrel, or you were a horse, or you were any kind of mammal, what in the world would you need to be on a synthetic hormone 24/7 to prevent one day of ovulation from taking place? But now, you see, with off-label use, we use birth control pills for everything, to, quote, regulate the period, to stop heavy bleeding. And all of that can be very, very useful. But if you step back and you change your food, which changes the way your hormones are metabolized, which changes the way you relate to the earth, then you find that you don't need all that stuff.
when you were speaking a moment ago about how women's bodies are managed, made to behave by drugs, really, and that if they eat healthfully instead, they really don't need to do that. Do you think that a healthy diet can contribute to sexual vitality for women and for men
as they
grow older?
Oh, yes. No, in fact, one of the biggest myths going around is that sex drive and sexual vitality naturally wanes around midlife. It's just not true. Alberto Villoldo, the wonderful shaman from Chile, points out that we are fueled by the dictates of our reproductive systems until midlife. But after that, we can become fueled from our radiant light bodies. And I think one of the most awful myths going around that manifests in people's lives in the most painful ways are that you will not have any sex drive after menopause. We have studies showing 50% of women have FSD, female sexual dysfunction. It's not female sexual dysfunction. It's a combination of two things. It is the end result of a poor diet with hydrogenated fats and insulin levels that are too high. And insulin levels that are too high literally wreak havoc with all the sex hormones, the sex steroids, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. In men, look at the number of men with that pot belly. That pot belly acts as an ovary in men. It produces a ton of estrogen. I talked with Harry Fish once, who is a male infertility specialist in Manhattan, and he said that there's two things. One, the big belly produces estrogen, which is anti-testosterone, and also it sits on the prostate and puts pressure on the venous return in the legs, all of which contribute to erectile dysfunction and lower libido in men. And yet, at the same time, there are very, very healthy, virile men having a great sex life in their 80s, even 90s. So we need to begin to study those people who are outside of the normal curve, which is one of the reasons why I love Dr. Martinez's work on healthy centenarians that he studied all over the planet. And he found out that they practice the causes of health. Isn't that a wonderful thought, the causes of health? And one of them is breaking bread in community. Now, even if you're gluten-free and you're not eating bread, it, symbolically, sitting down, having meals with others, enjoying food together is an incredible ritual of health and pleasure. So we need to start focusing on what are these causes of health. I like to say that eating whole, natural, organic food is like breastfeeding from Mother Earth. I was at the Santa Barbara Farmers Market last winter, and just the varieties of dates that they had were just astounding to me. And the fact that these beautiful people were making their living producing this beautiful food for people, it's holy to me.
When you mention those dates, I think about how I try to indulge with high quality choices and find healthier substitutes. I'll have a small piece of dark organic chocolate with a small glass of red wine, and that sends me through the roof. What are some of your favorite indulgences?
The dark chocolate, definitely. I have a little cupboard where I keep the 70% and up
yes.
of dark chocolate. And you're right, and just a small amount, because what happens is if it's high quality, you don't want more than enough. And that's an interesting thing. What I've noticed since I'm no longer doing surgery, I'm no longer in the hospital or delivering babies and all of that stuff, because when you are under that much stress, your cortisol is always high. And so therefore you crave something sweet to set off the opiates and make you feel better, because we know that opiates dull pain. And when you're at a job that you hate and you're working too long, then food becomes the drug. But when you begin to make deposits in your causes of health bank, which could start, by the way, by looking in the mirror every morning and saying, I love you. I really love you. The Louise Hay famous mantra. Even that will begin to change things. So my healthy indulgences are the dark chocolate, definitely really good high quality coffee. I can make myself a fantastic meal with whatever I always have around. I always have arugula and basil and onions and sweet potatoes, and I just bake those things or saute them. It's a real celebration, and I have not always been at this place at all because I was working so much. But now, when I prepare an evening meal for myself, it's a celebration with all of the foods that are just easy to get here. And I think where you are and where I am with the food revolution is we know it has to start with the earth, and she'll provide for us as long as we notice and give thanks and know where it's all going. And I see this movement is stronger than it's ever been. But you know what they say, as the light gets lighter, the dark gets darker. It's a new beginning for so many people, and many are realizing they can't continue doing what they're doing if they want to get healthy, stay healthy.
Well, when you speak about the earth, and I hear you talking about, you didn't use the word, but about reverence for life and for the earth, I keep thinking about how modern agriculture, industrial agriculture, in the way it treats animals and factory farms, in the way it treats the earth with pesticides and synthetic fertilizers, is the opposite of reverence. Yeah. And in fact, is exploitive, is predatory, is abusive. And I wonder if when our food is produced that way, does that, and we fuel ourselves from food that's produced that way, does that incline us, does that influence us in some way towards becoming more predatory, more abusive, more exploitive in our relationships to life, to other people, to the earth, to our own bodies?
I certainly think so. I've always thought, by the way, that the way in which we treat the earth is the way in which we treat our own bodies, especially for women. You know, the female body is seen as closer to the earth and less controllable and all that. And I think my work over the years in women's health has been very akin to kind of trying to redeem how we treat the body and how we treat the earth. And they're very parallel. And I also know the power of one person beginning to treat him or herself with respect and beginning to treat their food with respect has enormous implications. When you begin to act that way and be that way, well, if you look at your own life, so you had this revelation and a wake-up call about the food and what you were seeing, and you've spent your life doing that, and now here we are, and we have some clout, and suddenly you look behind you, and there's a whole group of people grateful that you created the trail. So I know that's where we're going. I don't even hope. I know that's where we're going.
Well, I know we are too. And a moment ago, you talked about you're no longer doing surgery.
Right.
When you were doing surgery, when you were doing your surgical training, when you were in the operating room frequently, did you notice variations in the quality of people's skin and tissues?
Oh, my God. That's such a great question. Yeah, we called it, believe it or not, I remember when I was first learning surgery, and one of my attending physicians was commenting on the tissue of this woman. We were doing a C-section, and you almost could separate the, you make the skin incision, but you could almost do the rest of it with your index finger. And he called it taco tissue. Like, this was just tissue from junk food, whereas the people who were healthy were able to heal so much faster. The integrity of their fascia, their tissue, was light years. I recently had a friend have a double hernia operation. Guy's in his 60s, and he was concerned that he'd have to have that mesh put in. But he is a master's level swimmer, eats all organic food, is just very health conscious. And the surgeon said, the quality of your tissue was so great that we didn't even have to go with a mesh. And he was diving into the harbor in his hometown a week later.
Some of your patients had connective tissue that was resilient and strong, while others had the same very same tissues were weak, poor quality, deteriorating. Did you see this tissue deterioration in even in younger people?
Yes, I saw it in teenagers. Yes.
Wow. And you saw a connection between the health that you saw in people's tissues and in the quality of their diets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we know from the famous Bogalusa heart study that they were finding, they found fatty streaks in the arteries of 8-year-olds.
I know that. I know that. It's amazing.
Isn't it? So it starts very early. We also know that the intrauterine environment can set the stage for your whole life. But what I want people to know, that becomes very deterministic and fatalistic, you know, like the genes for this run in my family, so there's nothing I can do. And that's the worst kind of use of genetic counseling that I have ever seen. It's much better to tell people about epigenetics, which is that the environment in which your genes find themselves is determined by your food, by your thoughts, by your beliefs, and by your behaviors and activities.
We're all highly trained in this culture to use sweets or alcohol as rewards. We associate cakes and ice cream and candy with birthdays and holidays and other kinds of celebrations. I have a friend who works out at a gym, and then afterwards, she always goes to a restaurant that's known for its very large and very sweet desserts, and she orders the biggest one on the menu, saying, "I earned this."
Wow.
You know, and watching her do this, the question that often comes to my mind is this how you want to reward yourself? Is this really a treat?
Again, it comes from the programming. You know, when food is love, remember Janine Roth's famous book, When Food is Love, or when you're brought up in your family that if you're good, you get dessert. If you're not good, you don't. So we as a culture need to work on other forms of reward. And I currently have a really young granddaughter. She's 16 months old. She's never had any refined sugar. She's not had any gluten. She eats grass-fed meats, and she eats vegetables and loves berries and fruits. Now, my daughter knows, just like I knew with my kids, that you only have up to a certain age before the child is part of a larger culture. What happens, and this is great news for anyone listening, I mean, I can vet this out from my own life. What your children are fed in their early life, what they remember as their mom's home cooking, the food that wires in love and security, is the food they had as children. And even if they fall off the rails, start making fun of your food and all of that stuff later, they will come back to what they learned early on. So my two kids eat beautifully because that's how they were brought up. And did they have a time when they went off the rails? Absolutely, in high school and college, but not very much, because increasingly what they found is they don't feel good. And I think that's a nice one. You can say to your kid, yeah, go ahead and do it. And then just report back to me how you feel. Because you and I both know, because you've had kids, when you tell them, do not do this, because they have to individuate, they have to do it. It's like I told my kids about the students who drank a lot of alcohol and did drugs. I said, now listen, by and large, you're going to find that they're not really happy kids, and they're using this to feel better. And I told them all about what peer pressure was, which is that the kid doesn't feel so good about themselves, but if they can enlist you, they'll feel a little better about themselves. And neither of my kids ever used any drugs. And I said, so what kept you from this? And they said, well, what you said was correct. They weren't very happy. And we saw this. So we said, why would we do this?
Well, that's really wise parenting. I'm glad that they listened and remembered what you said.
And I know, by the way, that there are kids who aren't going to listen, and that's when we get into soul contracts. So, you know, let's be clear that stuff that happens with your kids isn't always a reflection on you at all. Sometimes it is just the type of soul that you have a contract with. So we can lose the guilt on that one.
Yeah, what I experience you doing in how you've parented and how you are teaching us to parent ourselves or reparent ourselves is encouraging us to eat in a way that supports the happy, dynamic, sensual, intelligent, playful, spiritual, vibrant, creative person that's inside each of us.
Yes, we need to lose the righteousness. There's been a lot of righteousness in the food area. I like to think, you know, why does food bring up everyone's stuff? It's because food is mother. And there really is no human mother alive who can meet the needs of a child 100% like all of us would want. We want someone who's always there for us 24/7, telling us how precious we are and having the meal ready the minute that we want it. Well, the only way you're ever going to get that is to develop your own relationship with Mother Earth and your own relationship with your inner child.
I think that many of us are between two worlds.
Yeah.
We know that our old life in some ways isn't working, but we haven't quite yet established the new one.
That's right.
And how, when you're in a situation like that, and I think a lot of us are, it's a transitionary place, it's between, how do you release the old tribal programming about what you're supposed to say and do and think and be? And how do you find your true soul contract with life?
All right, that's a good one. I really believe that our job is to finally, in the new paradigm, right? The old paradigm is you're a miserable sinner, and you're going to have to, and if we're talking about diet, and you're going to have to cleanse and cleanse and cleanse, and, you know, you're dirty until proven otherwise. What if we just decided right now that everything was good, and we were doing it right? I think the only way out of the old paradigm is to find ourselves doing whatever we're doing and pronounce it right. Find yourself right, because that old paradigm of judgment and shame, all shame, as Brené Brown so beautifully points out, it cannot exist in laughter, in light, and in humor. Most great humor is based on the truth of someone's shame or pain, but you just finally shine a light on it, begin to make fun of it, and you don't take it so personally. When we can catch ourselves doing that, laugh at ourselves, and do it right, and pronounce ourselves right, everything changes. Because what we're so sure of is that we're being judged and we've done something wrong. That keeps the old in place. I like to say that anger and fear feed the dark forces. So stop feeding them. And then the other forces can shine more brightly.
It's ironic. We have often in our culture associated laughter and light and fun and joy and pleasure and with alcohol, with sweets, with ice cream, with candy, with cake, with all these things that actually undermine our ability to sustain a life of joy.
Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. It's like we, I don't like the taste of alcohol, so I've been spared, you know, that one. I just never could get any down. I come from the time we used to give women in premature labor IV alcohol. I kid you not, there was a belief that this would stop premature labor. So I remember all these poor women drunk out of their minds in premature labor. And I used to say the only way I'd ever get drunk is you'd have to give it to me IV. But generally, alcohol is a depressant. Sugar is a depressant. You're exactly right.
Well, they may be depressants, but they feel good for a few minutes for most people. Most people like the taste of sweets anyway, and many people like the high of alcohol. I personally, I've never had an issue with alcohol, but when I was in my teens, I would eat a bowl of ice cream in much the same way to drown my sorrows. I think we've probably all done something like that. We've eaten because we were bored or sad or lonely, and it maybe felt better temporarily, but it doesn't really support the person you ultimately want to be, and it doesn't help you become happy or whole, and it doesn't create a satisfying life. And how do we? That's just to me the crux of it. How do we shift so that we're making healthy choices, but not doing it out of shame or guilt? We're doing it out of love and appreciation for life.
You've got to make deposits in the self-esteem bank account. It's the only way. Like, you'll never stick with the program if most of your self-talk is abusive. You will not do it because you're going to do whatever it takes to feel better. But if you begin to find yourself right, if you begin to speak nicely to yourself, one of the things that's been really transformational for me is having a 16-month-old granddaughter. And I say to myself, would I talk to her the way I've been known to talk to myself? Would I ever treat her that way? And the answer is, no, like not ever. So you begin to start there. And then when you find yourself beating yourself up or saying, I can never do it right, then you've got to celebrate that when you catch yourself doing it. It is so paradoxical. So paradoxical. It's the exact opposite. Because what does our culture reward us for? Getting it right. What is the frickin' core curriculum in schools now running the educational system is coming up with the right test scores. So nobody's getting educated. They just learn how to get it right. So we have an entire generation terrified of making a mistake.
I think it really helps to have people in your life who reflect your capacity to grow and learn and change in a positive way, and that's what intimacy can be. We have hundreds of studies that show that when people have satisfying relationships that are empowering and where they feel seen and accepted, they're happier and they have fewer health
problems.
Absolutely. And they live longer.
That's really true. And it's true of all those healthy centenarians. They live in what Martinez calls subcultures of wellness. Subcultures of wellness. So this thing that we're doing here actually creates a subculture of wellness.
That's certainly what my intention is. You know, I want to tell you about a study that, yes, at some length, if I take a moment to do this. It was published in the British Medical Journal in 1993. I recently reread it, and it really struck me. I want to describe it in some depth and then get your thoughts. The researchers followed 750 men for 7 years. And at the outset of the study, the men were given a medical exam, and they were asked about their emotional stress. 7 years later, the researchers found that the men who had reported at the original part of the study being under serious emotional stress at the time of the initial exam, they were experiencing financial troubles, they were feeling insecure at work, or they were going through a divorce, those people had more than triple the risk of dying during the 7 years following the initial exam. So being under those kinds of stresses at the beginning of the study turned out to be a stronger predictor of dying within the ensuing 7 years than medical indicators such as high blood pressure or being overweight or high concentrations of blood triglycerides or really any other way they had of measuring risk factors. But what made this study really astonishing to me, and the reason I want to bring it up now, was that for those men who said at the outset of the study that they had a dependable web of intimacy, such as a loving spouse, there turned out to be no correlation whatsoever between high stress levels and death rate. It seems that having a substantial web of support and emotional support buffered the negative health impacts of even very serious stress. Now, that's just one study, but it speaks to me, and I think it's telling us something important. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, and you know what? I instantly thought of, there's this fantastic TED Talk called Everything We Know About Addiction Is Wrong. And here's what this guy, this is the research that he cites. We all know that if you put a rat in a cage and you give it water laced with heroin versus regular water, that rat in a cage will go for the heroin and eventually kill itself. Now, they've repeated the study, but when they put the rat in a cage with other rats, they have toys, they have social enrichment, the rat doesn't go to the heroin, ever. So as a result of rethinking what addiction is, because addiction is a solution to a stressful problem, it is a solution when there are no other solutions available. So based on this and many other studies, apparently the country of Portugal decided to stop making their addicts criminals. And as a result, then they would give them jobs and social support and all of that. So their rate of addiction has fallen by 50%. So it's exactly the same thing. When we have a social network that cares about us, then it ameliorates all the rest of it. This is why there's that famous study. It's a small town in Pennsylvania, Rosita or something. They had a whole bunch of Italian immigrants there. And they all lived till they were 100. And nobody died a heart attack, nothing. But the next town over did not have those close family ties, and their mortality rates were the same as everyone else's. The second generation, when the children began to leave home and do what we've done in America in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and on, which is have jobs in corporations where you move the family every 5 years, where you're torn asunder from your family ties, then the death rates of the children, the mortality rates rose. So it's a perfect example. Now, you would think, right, if you were a cardiologist or you were the chief of Harvard Medical School or community health, that study from the British Medical Journal, and there are many like that, that would be on the cover of the New York Times But it isn't. No, instead we're giving everyone statins, you see.
I know. You know, I've seen other studies that have looked at longevity and found that the quality of a person's relationships is central to the length of life and quality of life that they have. And I remember one study found that midlife women who were in highly satisfying relationships, mm-hmm. by their own definition of that, had a lower risk for cardiovascular disease and longer lifespans compared with those who said they were in less satisfying relationships.
Right, right. And so you can see it's not like, now we're back to where we started with the tribe and the shame and the abandonment and the betrayal. Because it
yes.
would make you think, well, I guess it's better for me to stick with this family and have the social ties that I have, even though it's killing my soul, because that's how important the social network is. Because it is. We have this this edge, you know, it's sort of like a razor's edge. So how did you, and how did I really, find the social support and the intimacy that you needed, even though your calling in the world was very different from your original family, and there isn't a question that you got a lot of flack for that.
You know, I did get social support from my wife, but I think even before then, there was a decision that I made inside myself.
Yeah.
And it was to live according to my inner light or inner guidance or higher power as I understood it, or any phrase you want to use, but not according to the expectations that would try to make me conform and obey and comply. And I wanted to find my own voice. I felt obligated. I felt responsible.
There it
to,
is. Okay. You were, that's the trajectory of the soul. You couldn't not do it. And I felt the same way. And so there are people like us that move the culture forward because we can't not do it. Even though the price that we pay looks fairly huge. I mean, if you and I were to sit down and talk about what it was really like when you were the voice crying in the wilderness.
Yes.
Yeah, this was not fun. We were just compelled. I remember when I was reported to the Board of Registration in Medicine here in Maine because by a general surgeon. He'd sent me a patient of his, and she had narrowing of her stool, and he said to me, she has bowel cancer until proven otherwise. And she came to see me, and she'd started a macrobiotic diet, and her stool caliber was normal, and she felt fabulous. And I said, okay, we don't know whether or not you have cancer, but we do know that your dietary change has reversed every symptom for which you went to see the general surgeon. So let's do this. Let's repeat all your tests at another institution in 3 months' time, because I happen to have one well-documented case of bowel cancer metastatic to the liver. Guy was married to a doctor. She put him on a macrobiotic diet, and he even went in for surgery. And a world-famous liver surgeon named Starzl just said, you're dying, and sewed him back up. And he went on to live and recover and have everything go away. So I told the woman about that one case, and I said, so if you are willing to do that, I'll order those tests for you. And she said, yes, that's what I want to do. That's what my soul tells me to do. I said, fine. And I wrote to her surgeon, told him the plan, and he instantly reported me to the Board of Registration in Medicine in Maine, and he said, is it the standard of practice in Maine to treat bowel cancer with a macrobiotic diet? And I went through hell because I didn't know if my colleagues would, and the woman herself wrote and said, no, this is my choice. And this doctor did nothing wrong. And, but still, still, you didn't know what the powers that be were going to say, and my own husband at the time sided with the general surgeon.
Ouch.
Ouch. So much for my social support in the house. And 3 months later, I was actually writing a letter, doing proprioceptive writing, and I spontaneously began to write a letter to the general surgeon, I'll never forget it, where I understood that he was coming from his, what he thought was his highest integrity to protect this patient.
Yes.
And so I forgave him, and something shifted in my solar plexus. And that day I went to Grand Rounds at the hospital, and one of my colleagues came up to me, and he said, I serve on the board of the of medicine, and the board unanimously decided to drop your case. Boom. We repeated her tests, and everything was completely normal. And at that point, I wrote to the surgeon and sent him the results, and I said, isn't the healing power of the human body miraculous? Now, my spouse at the time said, why didn't you ask him if it was the standard of practice of medicine in Massachusetts to remove normal bowel? I said, because the war has to stop with me. It has to stop with me.
Yeah.
But at the time, I remember thinking, if people are unable to choose their care from the dictates of their own souls, and if I can't practice medicine in that way, I will have to leave and become a cocktail waitress. I really actually said that, you know, if they had taken away my license or whatever it was.
Well, listening to you, Christian, I keep finding myself appreciating how outspoken you are and how willing you are and have always been to say, or maybe not always, but for a long time been, to say things that others and do things that others would find controversial or and upsetting. When I hear you speaking your mind so fully, and when I hear you tell stories of doing that under duress, when I hear you being so beautifully outspoken, I think that as well as conveying deeply needed wisdom and knowledge, you're also modeling something that can help us all, and particularly women in our culture. You remind us by your example how important it is to find life-affirming ways to express our thoughts and our feelings.
Thank you. It is that.
Well, Christian, it's been a pleasure as always speaking with you. I want to thank you for your wonderful work, for your outspoken nature, your beautiful passion, and of course, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Christian Northrup, bestselling author of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, and of her latest book, Making Life Easy. Christian, your work to understand and articulate the emotional, psychological, and spiritual dimensions of health is medicine for the body as well as for the heart and the soul. You've inspired millions of women and men to reclaim our health, our bodies, our pleasure, our lives. We want to thank you for your penetrating and provocative insights, for your brilliant leadership, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
I have loved every minute. Thank you, thank you, thank you for what you're doing for our Mother Earth as well.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.